Please come to order. We have members present, Senator Willickowski, Vice Chair Coghill, Stoltz, and Senator Huggins. We have a quorum to do business. Senator McGuire is in D.C. on Arctic policy business, I believe. We have several items before us. We're going to endeavor to get through all of them, but it was our hope to first take up the in deference to people that are serving in volunteer capacities to accommodate them, and starting the meeting with Ms. Hammond and Sandahl. Are they online yet?
We do have.
So no, we'll start with the first one. And after that we'll have a presentation of Senate Bill 62. We now have a regulatory bill in committee after discussing it for about a month. That appreciate the efforts of getting this forward, Senator Coghill. First, we'll commence with our the governor's appointments to the Police Standards Council. Mr. Sandahl, are you there?
Hello, Senator Stoltz. Yes, I'm here.
You're familiar with the process. We ask you to just identify yourself for the record, and this is really. You just very openly and candidly discussing why you were sought out to serve on this important board, and we will be very gentle.
All right, thank you, Senator Stoltz. And I'm over. So my name is Gus Sandahl, and I'm currently the chief of police for the Kenai Police Department. And I have over 19 years of law enforcement experience in the state of Alaska, all with the Kenai Police Department. And I was honored when I was selected for appointment for a first term to serve on the Alaska Police Standards Council. And I've enjoyed the interaction I've had with the professionals on the board. They have an important role of helping to ensure the appropriate standards for law enforcement in our state, and I feel we do a good job of that. And so I'm honored that Governor Walker is again is reappointing me for a second term, and I'll continue to work diligently. And first time I've worked diligently in preparation for the meetings, taking the role very seriously, and I will continue to do so and be a valued member of the Police Standards Council. So I really appreciate the consideration of the Senate Affairs Committee.
Mr. Sandahl, the members of the committee are very familiar, but there are a couple of cameras here for the public. Can you just describe what your duties are on this, and and what you've done in the past, and what are the challenges of this department, and just a thumbnail sketch so the public knows what we're dealing
with. Okay. So and members of the committee, just my roles in the Kenai Police Department. I've had a number of roles. I've enjoyed the challenges in my career, and I think all of that has helped me throughout my career, and recognized by peers as someone who's a hard worker and can provide an impact within my department and other committees that I contribute to in the law enforcement realm. As far as the Alaska Police Standards Council, a large role that we have involves taking a look at cases of misconduct involving police officers in the state of Alaska, and making a determination whether the officer's police certification should be revoked. And that takes up a bulk of our meetings. We meet twice a year. And then it depends on what other issues we might be facing that from meeting to meeting. Most recently, we had a discussion on changing some regulations within the Alaska Police Standards Council. So we're currently going through the regulation change process, changes to the regulations adoption process, and we're now in step three. And so that's something that I don't recall us dealing with prior to this year, other than having some discussions and concerns on some of the current regulations. And, you know, I can't say any of those are monumental, but just it was good that we're taking a look at some things that could be changed appropriately. That's about all I can think of right now.
And just also to inform the public, I understand a select amount of Alaskans participate in funding your department, your board. Can you, talk about your funding?
Yes. So the board is made up of 13 members. You have four municipal police chiefs. You have Commissioner of Public Safety or his designee, Commissioner of Department of Corrections, several public members, and then you have also three employees, staff of the Alaska Police Standards Council, the director, the training coordinator, and administrative assistant.
And your funding source?
You know, as far as the funding source,
surcharge
Yes, the surcharge is on tickets and misdemeanor and felony offenses. It's one of the funding sources to help.
This isn't
Alaska Police Standards Council assisting departments with training around the state.
Yeah, and this is part of an education process for the public as well. Any of you that might have gotten a speeding ticket, you've helped out. If you paid them. I have one question. First, I'll ask if there's any committee questions.
No, you ask mine.
I've had somebody has asked me to make an inquiry about the cross licensing of folks with arson experience, and you go from a fire department to a fire or arson investigator. And are you familiar with that issue? I'm still trying to get a handle on it, about how time and service is counted. Do you deal with those as a board member?
Senator Stoltz, to answer your question, that should start with the director of APSC, which would be Ms. Alda Harna. And from there, then that would be presented to us at a meeting. So it should start with her, and it would be most appropriate for her to answer that question.
Okay. You've answered my question. I have the roadmap, and the person here raised their hand, so I know where to direct the inquiry and follow the proper course. Thank you. I'm just using this hearing as an opportunity to ask that, but we don't need to bear out that's a personnel issue. Senator Huggins?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sandahl, I see where you are on board since 2011, and so we don't test any of our memories. Could you just give us a kind of an overview of a couple of issues that you dealt with in the year 2014 that, you know, had in your mind some importance to them?
I'm sorry, sir, but your last sentence faded out there.
Yeah, in 2014, could you just give us a quick thumbnail sketch of a couple of issues that you think were important that you dealt with?
Yes, sir. Aside from the cases of misconduct that we had to consider for decertifying, I mean, that's always a very important issue. And so those stand out naturally. And aside from that, the number one issue that's standing out is from our last meeting in December is the proposed changes to the regulations. And those were in draft form, and there are too many changes for me to.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you so much.
But some are subtle and some are a little more significant.
Yeah, no, I understand. Thank you very much, and good luck on your confirmation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Sandahl, were you in Colorado in January? I think I may have met you there. Was that?
Yes, Yes, I was, Senator Stoll.
Okay. Very good. It's. I look forward to having some invited testimony in our process from local police departments, especially those that have had the outreach and as part of our. So I'll my office will work with you and other local constabulary to arrange for some participation in this process as we're dealing it. And we look forward to that. And I'm glad that you've gone out to gain ancillary information as well.
Yes, it was a very worthwhile conference. And
they didn't give us
much. Likewise, I appreciate it.
There wasn't much breathing room time. We started at 7 in the morning, and we ate lunch on our lap in the auditorium and finished around 6. So and I appreciated the seriousness of that conference, and that there were far more local officials there than from Alaska than by far than anyone else, any other entity. So glad.
Yes, sir, I agree.
All right. Any other questions for the chief? Thank you very much for your service, and look forward to seeing your name sometime in April.
All right. Thank you very much for your consideration.
All right. Thank you, sir. Is Ms. Heyman online or Heyman? Oh, well, the next appointment, Ms. Heyman, I believe. I'm not sure. You'll
yes,
correct.
This is Rebecca Heyman.
Oh, thank you. Just same.
I'm sorry, I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
Sure. Just the same procedure as Mr. Sandell has gone through, and probably less questions for you since we asked he was first. Go ahead and tell us what your name is, a little bit about your background, and your role, and hopes and aspirations for your duty as a volunteer on the Police Standards Council.
Thank you. So my name is Rebecca Heyman, and my current profession is I am the village and the legal advocate. I work for Safe and Fear-Free Environment, which is based out of Dillingham, about 100 miles away from here. And we offer advocacy to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. And I personally cover the villages throughout the Lakin Peninsula borough and the Bristol Bay borough, so about 16 villages in all. And for legal advocacy, I work with all the cases that come through the Mackinac District Court. So I'm very involved in the issues, the epidemic of sexual assault and domestic violence that we face in Alaska, especially in the villages. And that is what my main background is. I've been working for SAFE and living out here in King Salmon for quite a few years. I find that being on the Police Standards Council is a very interesting experience and very very enlightening. It's helped me a lot in understanding the how to have a better relationship with law enforcement as we work with to support victims. And I feel like I bring a little bit of a different outlook to certain questions because I work with victims and with law enforcement all the time. And I found that personally I can understand better the issues that law enforcement face since I've had some time on the council.
Any questions for Ms. Heyman? I have one, and that's you've mentioned a subject area that's enshrined in our Constitution, and that's victims' rights. I found in dealing with victims' rights, it's almost an education process with each new commissioner that comes in, and a lot of the the first contact points is an understanding and helping enforce the victims' rights provision in our state constitution. Are you familiar with that constitutional amendment and that's now part of our Constitution. And are we doing well on that from our police departments, or could we improve? What's your feeling on that?
I feel like it might vary from department to department, but I feel like there's a lot of attention on the issue at the moment, and that is very helpful because people are aware that there might be an unevenness or some injustice in the past, and so people are working hard. All the departments I work with are working hard to do a better job with victims and to develop more of a team approach with helping victims and their families go through their experience and then also to navigate the court system after when their charge is brought. And that's all a very complicated and foreign world for many victims. But I feel like their experience, at least in the state of Alaska, is improving.
Well, you have the vernacular down, so it's clear you understand Article 1, Section 24. So, appreciate that.
Yes. I couldn't quote it to you, but I do understand it.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you very much. And Ms. Hammond, thank you again. And I see you've been on the board since 2011. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe so, yes. Yeah.
In that time frame, since 2011, what do you think the couple of pieces that you have contributed to the commission over that time, what would you single out or a couple things that you would want to inform us on that you made a difference in the conversation and debate?
I'm sorry, you were cutting out quite a bit during that time, so you were asking about a few cases that I participated in?
Yeah, my fault, I was too far from the mic. As your duties on the commission since 2011, could you just describe a couple of issues that you think yourself sitting on the commission made a difference in the debate or discussion?
So I would have to say that for the first year or so, or maybe more, I felt like I was very much in learning, trying to understand what the Police Standards Council does and trying to kind of form a better picture of the point of view that law enforcement comes from in the decisions that they make. But as the years have gone by, I feel like I have grown to understand better the standards that Alaska wants to hold our peace officers to, and better how sometimes those relationships work or don't work with the communities that we serve. And so I can't bring up a particular case, but especially where police officers had misbehavior that involved a victim that they were already working with, I felt that those cases were really deserved a lot of my attention, and I found that very interesting to go over with the council.
Yeah, thank you very much. And just to follow up, and this has more to do with your daily duties, and I asked the question so maybe you can help educate some of us. I know that you have good fishing at Knack Knack, and it's a good place to refuel your airplane. And south of there, lots of big bears, but I don't know much about the Knack Knack District Court. Could you just give us a little bit of feel, the best you could, about when you look at the district court, but particularly caseloads and your interface and your duties in the sexual assault and domestic violence advocacy? Could you just, in about 2 minutes or less?
Okay. I'm sorry, I couldn't tell if you were finished with your question. It's still very cutting, you know.
Over. Over.
Cutting
over. Go ahead. Over.
So you were asking about the typical caseload of an ethnic district court. Is that correct?
Correct.
So of court cases that involve domestic violence or sexual assault or something at least somewhat related to those to two subjects. I would say that we actually do maybe three or four trials, or maybe five trials per year. And in those trials, usually what I do is I support the victims and their families and other witnesses during the trial, and I also act as a support and assistant to the assistant district attorney who is trying the case. And we don't have them every week or every month, of course, but I do try to be involved in any of them that have to do with our subject of interest.
Thank you very much, and good luck on your confirmation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? I appreciate the members, Ms. Heyman's knowledge of victims' rights. It far surpasses any that I've ever heard from a commissioner, or that the language was very consistent with a understanding and sensitivity to Article 1, Section 24, and the mission of the Victims' Rights Constitutional Amendment that 84% of Alaskan voters approved in, I believe, in 1994. So I, good on you, Ms. Heyman. With that, I thank you for taking time from your day to participate in this proceeding. I hope it was certainly meant not to. Certainly it's never an inquisition here, unless there may be one of your commercial fishing friends there. But that, and that's just
so thank you for your time and consideration also.
We'll assign the report at the end of the meeting, but if there's no objection, we'll forward these to the floor with our standard language on the appointment forms. Thank both of both the chief and Ms. Heyman for your time this morning. Thank you very much. With that, we'll just have a brief at ease while Mr. Hutchinson gets ready for his presentation. After a brief at ease, Senator Coghill, some introductory remarks for the legislation that you and I believe Senator McGuire is that a fair characterization? Well, I'll let you in your.
This comes out, the Senate Bill 62 is a product coming out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Probably the three people working on it the most are Senator Machicki, Senator McGuire, and myself. Staffing probably mostly out of my office and Senator McGuire's office. The issues that were presented to us by the initiative were, first, how do we deal with the penalties of misuse, which was the first bill that went traveling through. Now this is the regulatory, kind of the industry part of it, which looks for how to give the industry a good structure to work out of, and it's also trying to keep an industry from encouraging the black market. And so the sponsor statement has given the seven things that it's basically trying to do, remembering, we always are trying to remember as we run through the scheduling that the federal government still sees it as a Schedule 1A drug, I think, is anyway there, it's a controlled substance. So we're trying to navigate through this kind of enterprise world on how to do that. So Mr. Hutchison has got all the mechanics, and some of them are still I'm working on understanding. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And just for the public's edification, after Mr. Hutchison's presentation, which we'll proceed through with limited interruptions, only to just to clarify or ask questions on a point, we won't have time. But I think we'll get through it more efficiently, and then questions afterward, and then afterwards we're going to have response and comments from the initiative sponsors, Dr. Hinterberger, and if he's online, Mr. Schulte, who has provided a fairly lengthy response in written form. I believe every member has received sometime yesterday. So with that, Mr. Hutchinson. And when I do this, that means you're talking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chad Hutchinson. I work for Senator Coghill. As Senator Coghill stated, SB 62 is the commercial marijuana bill. It is presented by the Senate Judiciary Committee. We are working closely with Senator McGuire and Senator Manchiki on this issue. The purpose of today's presentation is to set some foundational issues. This committee in particular will recognize some of the discussion topics. We've integrated some of the testimony that's been occurring in State Affairs over the previous weeks into this version of SB 62. So some of the material will definitely be familiar to the committee members.
Keep going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will spend time on a newer portion that specifically discusses the commercial licenses, which people have a high degree of interest in. So we're gonna go through some of the sections more quickly, the ones that the committee's already reviewed, and we're going to spend more time on some of the license provisions. And to make sure it's clear, going back for just one moment, the two primary focuses that Senator McGuire and Senator Coghill have designated to us is we want to make sure that the young people are protected and that we're eliminating the black market. So that's some of the logic behind some of the licensing provisions that you're going to see. And if, to be frank, if history is any indicator, this bill probably will be subject to amendment if we look at the history of the criminal version of the marijuana bill. So SB 62 starts with the ballot measure 2. I'm going to focus specifically on the commercial provisions. What changed this with ballot measure 2? As we are now aware, there's legitimate ability for taxpayers to interact in a business sense with the commercial sale of marijuana. Marijuana can be sold by businesses. There are some provisions and structure that was set up in ballot measure 2 to ensure labeling and safety of consumers, and that's stuff that's an element that we've incorporated in SB 62. Some of those provisions you see on the slide is issues that we've talked about in this committee before, so I won't spend much time to it. Person of 21 years of age can possess, display, transport 1 ounce or less. There's the Raven provisions, 4 ounces for personal use. You have 6 plants, 3 or less, maybe mature flooring. We've covered those provisions in State Affairs before. The no public consumption portion. That's something that's been known. There's been an emergency regulation that's come out by the MPC board related to that specific issue, and it basically limits or restricts marijuana use in public places such as highways, transportation facilities, areas of that nature, schools. So here's some of the statutory requirements that were implemented by ballot measure 2. Some of these are going to be subject to change, and you'll see that there are differences in the language we have with SB 62 versus what was instituted with ballot measure 2. So this is the foundational material here. There's AS 1738070 and 1738900, the definition component of the ballot measure, set up by the ballot measure. There you see there's multiple marijuana establishments. One's the cultivation facility, one's the product manufacturing facility, one's the testing facility, one's the retail store. We've modified a few of those provisions in SB 62. You'll see some of the definitions have changed, but the essence of what was required by the ballot measure remains from the perspective of the Senate Judiciary Committee members that are working on this bill. They also talk about having a current valid registration. You'll see that has changed too, and the reason why is because the advocates of the ballot measure 2 have said that they wanted to be regulated like alcohol. What comes with that is licensing provisions, which we'll touch on more in depth in a few moments here. There's a few rulemaking deadlines. The State Affairs has reviewed this a few times. The board is required to, within 9 months, implement regulations related to Chapter 38, the marijuana provisions. There's a few elements that need to be included: civil penalties, labeling requirements, security requirements, qualifications for registration. You see those on the slide there. we've gone over this before. They have 1 year from February 24, 2015 to begin accepting applications for processing of the commercial license. The expectation is around May 24th or the date upon which the first licenses are issued. That's when you're going to see the first legal commercial marijuana sales. So that's a review for this committee. There's local participation and control provisions that we've included with SB 62 that we'll get in depth in a few moments. These are what was outlined by ballot measure 2. They created AS 1738-100 and AS 17-110, and that's local government control. They can prohibit establishments, they can establish civil penalties, they can determine operating fees in some cases, they can do time, place, and manner restrictions in certain capacities. It also creates the ability for local regulatory authority. There is a question about the collection of fees associated with some of the registration, whether that's going to be half by the local authority or half by the board. We've outlined, I think, a different strategy that perhaps is a little bit cleaner, and that's with the input from some of the stakeholders. There's implication, there's the providing of input to applications of the board. I understand with liquor licenses as it pertains now, the boroughs do have the ability to give no protest recommendations to the board if they so deem necessary. There's issues related to whether if the state fails to adhere to the Chapter 38 deadlines, and we've set up kind of a Plan B provision related to in SB 62. So you're going to see those distinctions when we go throughout the different sections of the bill.
And Mr. Hutchinson, can you just reference the initiative on deference to local control? Just explaining that this isn't necessarily a legislative mandate, but can you discuss that just in general?
Chairman Stoltz, yes, that the distinction that most understand the bill to be is that there is the ability for local authorities, if they so deem, to have an ability to have local control, much like you see with the alcohol provisions that currently exist with wet and dry communities. There's the ability of local communities to determine if they want marijuana establishments, marijuana producers, processors, retailers in their community. You see that same provision as it pertains to Colorado. Colorado has about a third of their counties have decided that they don't necessarily want the marijuana establishments. So there is that element of local control, which I believe is an important part of the ballot measure, and that's what was understood by most folks voting on it.
So it'd be legal to possess it and use it, but you'd have the local government could regulate whether or not you could manufacture and distribute it in that community. Is that
true? Chairman Stoltz, that's correct.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Okay, so anything else? There's a few things that we've touched on this committee before. The Raven decision is unaffected. You still can have personal use marijuana in your own home, up to 4 ounces. The marijuana DUI laws are unaffected. You still cannot drive inebriated with an intoxicant as it relates to marijuana. Medical marijuana laws are unaffected. The provisions still remain in 1737, where you still, if there is a debilitating medical condition, you still can get a recommendation from your doctor and apply for a register for medical marijuana use. The private property provisions, they still have the ability to prohibit marijuana on their private property. So what about taxes? This is one of the key components of SB 62. It talks about taxes. This is going to come anytime you're talking about the commercial sale of marijuana. There was, according to the ballot measure, an excise tax of $50 per ounce. The idea behind the ballot measure was it was to be implemented when it was sold or transferred from the cultivation facility. You'll see that in SB 62 we've modified that slightly, and the reason why we did that is because it segues into the theme of eliminating the black market, and you'll see how we're coming to grips with that and how the stakeholders have given recommendations based on the experiences that they've learned in Colorado and Washington to help diminish the black market. I elimination of the black market completely is going to be difficult in any circumstances. So the key word should actually be, we're diminishing the black market. That's what we're attempting to do with this bill. Get them all into a legal environment, controlled environment, and that's safer for the young people that may... it's just safer for the young people if you get it into a regulated environment.
Any people?
Chairman Stoltz, yes, any people. That's correct. So that's the provisions we need to be cognizant of, is that there is that $50 per ounce excise tax, and we'll see how that's implemented in our proposed solution with SB 62.
Are there limits? You believe the initiative limits local governments from also charging taxes? Or is it a free-for-all like on cigarettes?
And Chairman Stoltz, I would state that the $50 excise tax is what we're comfortable with at this point as far as from the
producers. Now, not a subjective of whether that's the right amount for the state, but is that do local governments have the ability to charge under your scenario?
Chairman Stoltz, the answer is yes, they can charge municipal taxes at the retail level, just like any other sales taxes, or in addition to whatever the excise tax is. So they do have that ability.
Are there any Title 29 provisions that you're aware of that would prevent communities that don't have a sales tax from having a sales tax on a specific item?
Chairman Stoltz, I'm not aware of any, but I'd be happy to look at that. And
we're regulating like alcohol. Alcohol has been a pretty active business interest, and they have some Title 29 interests.
And Chairman Stoltz, and that may be true. That'll be something I'll have to get back to you.
Thank you.
That information. So what can the state do? The state does have a degree of flexibility. They can amend the initiative as long as they don't effectively repeal, which is what we've tried our best to do with SB 62 in a very disciplined manner, where we're still recognizing that there's an element of the population, majority element of the population that has looked for commercialization of marijuana, but you're also balancing that with the fact that it is a controlled substance, it is an intoxicant, and you do have public policy issues that you need to be considerate of. So that's what we tried our best to do with the bill. You may amend implied consent, DUI, open container laws. That's what we're trying to do with the criminal version of the marijuana bill. You can fill gaps, which is what we're attempting to do with SB 62, and you can promulgate regulations. So, ballot measure 2, it spawned a number of bills. There's a list there, and just yesterday, HB 133, which is the sister companion bill to SB 62, was right across in the House. So there's the expectation that there is the commercial marijuana bills that will be moving potentially through both bodies. At least they've been introduced in both bodies. So let's get into some of the provisions of SB 62 specifically. Like I said before, some of these will be a review for this committee because they'll be very familiar because these are based off some of the conversations we've had in this committee. So Section 1 is the inspection and certification of marijuana testing facilities. This is done through the Department of Environmental Conservation, and the intent is to have samples of marijuana sent to these facilities for testing as it relates to the THC amount, things of that nature. Section 2 deals with the authorization of marijuana accessories authorized for people over the age of 21 years old. Section 3 deals with limitations on advertising. Specifically, we want to ensure that there's no direct advertising to minors. Section 4 is that the board is retired to adopt regulations of commercial license. This is
just anticipating future inquiries. Once you describe the board as you're talking about what they are allowed or required to do, the construct.
Chairman Stoltz, and the board, when I reference the board, it's either the Marijuana Control Board, if we choose to pass that bill and set up the Marijuana Control Board, or in the alternative, the ABC Board, the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, which will have the presumptive authority if there is no Marijuana Control Board. So when
that
I say
that is the initiative sponsor's default position.
That is
the ABC board.
That is the default position, provided there's no marijuana control
by as named by the initiative sponsors.
I believe that to be the case. Okay, yes.
Thank you,
Senator Stoltz. Thank you. So, going on to Section 5. Section 5 specifically talks about packaging and labeling of marijuanas and ensuring that there's certain child protection elements related to that packaging. Section 6 discusses applications of renewals, and the idea is whenever there's a renewed license coming up, that there has to be 90 days before that expiration notice that the license needs to be renewed. Section 7 is the fee payment provision. It's really straightforward. It says that upon receiving an application, a renewal shall immediately forward a copy to the local regulatory authority for the municipality in which the applicant desires to operate the marijuana establishment. This is based on a revised provision that was found in the ballot measure that looked to split some of the license fees 50-50 between the municipality and the board. We think this is perhaps a cleaner way of approaching that issue. Section 8 deals with the board having 90 days to issue an annual license.
Is that to make to issue or to make a determination on the issuance of? Is there an imperative that the license be issued, or is it to make a decision?
Senator Stoltz, it's to issue an annual license. It has 90 days, and then if there isn't an issuance of that license, the applicant has the ability to go to a local regulatory authority, and that's the starting presumption that you'll see.
Thank you.
So Section 9. So moving on to slide 14, section 9, the board shall consider local municipality numerical limits. And this gets into what I consider to be kind of the local control provisions in this bill. Local municipalities can set limits based on public testimony, based on the feelings of the community in the whole as to how many marijuana producers they want in the community, or retailers, or processors.
Section would this be akin to regulating it like alcohol, as the title?
Similar dynamic? Senator Stoltz, just like when there's a liquor license that comes before the Alcohol Control Board, the one I'm most familiar with is the Borough Assembly in Fairbanks, where they can have the ability for people to come up and testify and determine if they would like the establishment in their community or not, and then the Borough Assembly can give a recommendation to the board. So it's equivalent to that. There's other things that they also consider with taxing, zoning, things like that.
Would be a municipality under current alcohol regulations can set up limits by population or by other jurisdictions, types of vendor?
Senator Stoltz, I've heard that discussed before, but Cynthia Franklin's probably a better source.
I'm really getting at, is this consistent with the way alcohol is regulated? Is that your target?
Senator Stoltz, that is correct. Okay, that is my target.
I probably didn't ask it correctly at first. Thank you. That's all I wanted.
That's my target, yes.
Okay.
So Section 10, this is a disclosure requirement. The marijuana establishment shall disclose where they will operate. So people in the neighborhoods, they want to know if there is a producer, if there's a large producer, or if there's a boutique dealer, which is up to 50 plants, or if there's a home grower in their community. They have the ability to know where that is at. So that's something that we're balancing the public policy provisions, understanding that this is still a controlled substance and it's still an intoxicant. So that was the proposed solution is found in Section 10. Section 11 is a municipality may prohibit a marijuana establishment, the enactment of an ordinance or a voter initiative. This is what I discussed earlier, that just like smaller communities have the ability to vote whether they want to be a wet or dry community as it pertains to the alcohol, we're given that same sort of freedom as it relates to marijuana. Section 12 is time, place, and manner restrictions on marijuana establishments, and you can determine when the hours of operations are going to be for retail facilities or production facilities. Section 13, the municipality may process applications within the boundaries of the municipality if the board fails to adopt regulations. So these are the Plan B provisions, provided that the board, for whatever reason, does not get the regulations as they were required to do by the ballot measure and the other provisions of SB 62. So the municipality does have that flexibility to process applications within the boundaries of the municipality and look to act in the event that the board does not. So you'll see a lot of these provisions are very similar in that vein of thinking. Section 14 allows the municipality to the ability to issue, suspend, or revoke a license. Section 15, a municipality may establish a schedule for annual licensing, so that's just the scheduling provisions and renewals, things of that nature. Section 16 deals with the applicant resubmitting their application. If the board does not act within May 24th, 2016, this is something that I touched on earlier with Senator Stoltz. They have that ability in case that the board is not operational or if they haven't been able to assess the credibility of the application. Section 17, going on to slide 16. Section 17, if the board does not adopt regulations on time, the local regulatory authority may issue an annual license. Again, this is more of the same. It gives the local regulatory authority the ability to act in the event that the board does not. Section 18, again, 90 days after the receiving application, paralleling what we've seen before about the time frames for issuance of the license. The license shall have the same force of effect as those issued by the board. That's in Section 19. Section 20 is amended to read that a renewed license issued by the municipality may be issued on the annual basis upon resubmission to the municipality. Okay. So this is getting in closer into what people have the highest degree of interest. And this talks about the types of license in Section 22. And Section 21 is just more of what we've stated before. As it relates to local regulatory authority, the real interest that folks have is in Section 22 and the types of licensing. And as you can see there, there's a few different licenses that one can apply for. And the question always is, well, why do you have so many licenses? Because there's many different types of marijuana operations. You're going to have the big greenhouses that have hundreds of plants, maybe thousands. You have the smaller homegrown operations that are going to be for personal use that you're looking at upwards of six plants. You're going to have medium-sized plants, and you're going to have an element of this population that's going to be taken from an illegal market. It was a black market, and you're trying to do whatever you can to emphasize to them that they want to join the legal market, that you want to get them out of the black market and into the legal market. So that's why you see the different type of licenses. So you have the producer's license. That's the big license for the big greenhouses. You have the two, number two is the processor license, which I'll explain in a moment. You have three, the retail license, so they do the sales. You have the boutique producer license, and this is under 50 plants. You have the broker's license, which is essentially he's kind of the middleman. He buys and sells the marijuana, and he might sell it to a processor. They take the plant, and they put it into an edible. Things like that. So he's going to handle marijuana, but he's mostly kind of a middleman money entity. And then you have the home grower's license, which is the reason why we have this is because we want to encourage the people that are what we believe to be currently home growing right now into the legal market. And then Section 22 also deals with testing, notice provisions, license procedures, things of that nature. So there is there's kind of a side-by-side as to what they look like and a small explanation of what it is. I want to explain the vertical license. This came after we had discussions with people from Colorado and Washington. There's an interest in having a license where one entity is the producer, is the processor, and the retailer. So that came from those discussions. And then there's other entities that just want to be the producer and the processor and developed a license just for them. So you see that on the right-hand side with vertical license. And this is something I touched on before, why so many licenses? Well, here you can see how many different licenses. I didn't even include the permits for alcohol. But those are the different licenses that are in the alcohol industry in Alaska right now. And you see you have a brewer who's different from a club license, who's different from a package store, who's different from a pub. So there's going to be those sorts of distinctions, I think, as we go forward that'll come out in the marijuana industry as the years go on. So I suspect there's going to be a further refinement on the different types of licenses. So here's an explanation as to the cultivation license. This is the producer. This is the big marijuana greenhouse that I was discussing earlier. They have more than 50 plants. They can grow, harvest, and process raw marijuana, and they sell to licensed retailers and licensed processors. And notice I say they're always licensed. We want this as legal as possible. We want people we don't want illegal sales going to licensed people. We want licensed producers selling to licensed retailers, and then it's turned down to the customers after testing. And if they're an edible product, we want to make sure they go through the processing, which is licensed too. So we're very clear we want to make sure that's licensed. I think that's a dynamic they've been trying to institute in Colorado and Washington to the best of their ability. I think we should follow that model if possible. There's the tax that we talked about earlier. The tax is assessed for the big producers because they have the ability to pay that $50 per ounce or proportionate ounce for the marijuana. They have that ability, so we can assess the tax at that level. This is the marijuana processor license. This is the one that's creating the edible products. It's creating the beverages. It's the one that's infusing the marijuana concentrate in some capacities onto other goods, the food goods. These facilities are only authorized to wholesale products to license marijuana retailers and to brokers. So we're setting up a structure there where they have limitations as to who they can sell to. And they do not have a tax burden because the tax burden, if they're buying from the big producers or the brokers, is already instituted at that level. So the tax burden is just passed on through the supply chain, through the automatic price, whatever they're buying the materials at. That $50 per ounce tax burden is already incorporated into it from the producer itself.
Since you put the word in here, you need to probably define it, and it's a new word to you even, the tinctures. They have edibles, we know what that is. You even had to describe what a concentrate was. So tell us what this tincture is.
Sure. Tinctures is an infused solution, is what I've discovered. So that's it's an infused solution is the best way I can do it. I understand it in a certain extent, and I'm no marijuana expert in this regard. But it has to do with...
You're a marijuana policy expert, right?
Senator Schultz, that's correct, yeah.
Okay.
So that's my best definition I can give you. It's an infused solution. And the concentrates, I did a brief amount of research, and to me, it hash, the wax products, things like that.
Is that tincture? Is that where you take an existing product and inject that in and infuse it, or is it... It's not. I see a negative. Not for the record, but Mr. Schulte has a lot of familiarity. He nodded negatively.
Yeah, I Senator Schulte, I defer to Mr. Schulte on.
You know, not usually that casual with people in the audience, but just for expeditions.
Sure, and I would defer to others to explain the actual physical elements of the tinctures.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The note of license does not have a state tax burden is interesting. I'm not a big tax guy, and I'm not advocating for tax at this level. What I am advocating for and would ask you if you've talked about it is that the state has a clawback provision if, in fact, year one, two, three, you name your number of years, that we're actually losing money on the marketing of marijuana. Does that make sense? Because when we put this bureaucracy into place, no matter good, bad, or indifferent, I'm one of those people who think we're going to lose money, particularly if you look at the medical aspects of the implications on social behavior. But I may be wrong, but I don't think we should be subsidizing an industry, for lack of a better term.
And
still more marijuana.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, the way the processor de facto pays the tax is because it's built into the marijuana that he's buying that was taxed at the producer level. So that $50 tax that was assessed on the producer is passed on through the supply chain to the processor. So he's paying for that increased amount that adds the tax that the producer already paid. That's
no, I get that. All right, I got it. I mean, it's kind of like cotton to a white shirt to somebody buys it. On the other hand, my point is across that marketing, whether it's the person that fertilized the plant to the point of somebody buys an edible, that if the bureaucracy that you're describing to us is in place, but it's costing us money as a state, we're subsidizing industry. And I'm just saying, if we had that conversation, and are you comfortable that we won't get ourselves into that position?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, I can tell you that we have had those conversations, and there is a percentage of the population that believes this will be a net negative for us for the first couple of years while we get our feet underneath us. I think once we get more experience with the process, the price and the cost associated with the state, will go down once you have a regulated market. Hopefully, some of the collateral consequences as it relates to the detrimental mental health effects, things like that, will go down because it'll be a regulated product that they have more control over, rather than anyone just being able to buy it in the black market existing as it is, where everybody has potential access if they really want it. So that's the intent. But I think many agree with you that the first couple of years, that there is a high probability this will end up costing us more than the benefits to begin.
We will have Commissioner Hoff back, where we want him, not a designee, to come in and fully outline that, because we're dealing with fiscal issues as well as this responding to the citizens' initiative. So for the committee's edification, we will have him. Our expectation, we want the commissioner himself to speak about the department's position and how this impacts revenue. And I know that we will. He certainly can invite the cheerleader from his department in the division, Mr. Alper, but we want a policy directive and implications from the top of the food chain there. That's a statement. I'm not asking you to respond to that.
And thank you, Senator Stoles, and thank you for the question, Senator Huggins. Okay, so we're moving on to the retailer. The retailer, of course, can provide the product to folks that are 21 years of age or older. There are restrictions about what the retailer can do. They cannot cultivate. They cannot process under the standalone type of license. The licensee does not have a state tax burden, but, and this is what I referred to with Senator Stoltz before, they do have they are responsible for additional municipal taxes, so that's they will have that if the local municipality so deemed it appropriate. So this is the boutique dealer. This is the boutique producer, and people ask, well, Chad, what does that mean? It's the licensee that's permitted to grow not more than 50 plants, and the idea is there's a black market that exists right now, and you have these people that exist that already grow under 50 plants, that already grow pursuant to the Raven provisions, and what you're trying to do is you're trying to encourage these people to come into a legal, regulated market. So you want to have the barrier of entry as low as possible in order to get them into a legal supply chain, so you can, you know, the product isn't being spread around in an unregulated way. So that's the solution that people have surmised, is that you create different licenses to address the already existing black market. So the boutique dealer is one way that we address that. It does not have a state tax burden like the big producers do, and people ask, why is that the case? Because most of these folks, they're probably not paperwork intensive. They don't have the money that the big producers do, and you're doing everything you can to try and encourage them into a legal market. That's what you're trying to do. So you want to make the burdens for entry as low as possible for those boutique dealers and for those home growers, so they're not just deciding to just exist in the black market, and then you have, you know, the product with, you don't know how much THC is arriving to the teenagers or the young folks or anybody. You want to encourage them into the regulated market. So that's the reason why you see the boutique dealer as a little bit.
Can you, as this bill progresses, can you give us some other similar comparable licensing requirements where there's disparate entry fees for participants in an industry? So that's a research project for you.
Sure. And if I could respond, Senator Stoltz, quickly, and one of the things that we're looking at, as far as, I want to make sure this clears too, is that we've, at one point in time, we were considering just assessing amounts for licensing fees. We now deferred, if you look through the bill, we defer to the board to determine what the licensing fees are going to be for these individual producers, for the home growers, based on what the board feels is appropriate for how much money they're spending, and then looking at the assessment as it relates to the actual producer itself. So I want to make sure that part's clear.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
Yeah, thank you. To be honest, this provision reminds me of legalizing moonshine. But it has the same characteristics. But lo and behold, we're encouraging people to make moonshine. We just say you got to sell it to this particular person. So we've all lived through that era or watched some of the movies on it. Of course, NASCAR, that's where it emanated from. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
It's good to get the Southern perspective,
yeah.
Senator.
Yep. And Senator Huggins, I appreciate the question. And that's just a problem that we're going to have to deal with as we as we try to assess how do we eliminate the black market, and even with moonshine, if we can get regulated moonshine, I think that's the preference than moonshine that's made in people's bathtubs and just given out and who knows what you're drinking. So that's part of the logic behind this
boutique. And as we progressed with the bill, as the campaign of last year went on, there was a lot of discussion about cottage industries, and many of the folks in my district looked at this opportunity. But if you look at this nationally, there seem to be a lot of barriers, and there's the people that finance the effort are large players, and how do we deal with that, the expectations of the public? And I won't try to pretend to assess motives of what people said they were they voted yes or no, and that's a yes, we can do it. But there certainly is the large business dynamic in this, and we're going to be very welcoming of any suggestions on how to deal with what we can construe as the what people's expectations were. I can only speak for folks in my area, by and large, but that's a challenge for the committee to. I think that's one of our larger ones.
And Senator Stoles, I'll go through these a little more quickly. I know we have time constraints. I make myself available if there's any questions.
We're the one delaying you, so please proceed.
So now I move on to the home grower. Home grower has got some special provisions in it. We're trying to eliminate the black market. We're trying to encourage the people that already are home growers right now to get into the legal market. You'll notice that with the home growers, there is a unique provision, and that's as it relates to the ID number that verifies the grower's age and the Alaska residency. That's an idea that spawned from Colorado, which has implemented a similar structure. They want to know the ID of every seed and all the way to the sale of the marijuana. They want to keep track of all the different plants that are in the state of Colorado. The logic here is that we're setting up a similar system as it relates to the home growers in Alaska. And the idea is it'll keep track of who the home growers are, which there will be notice provisions that they have to disclose who they are anyway, but also to make sure to keep them honest as to what license they have. If they're selling more than six, if they're selling more than what their license provides, then they're going to be required to have a different license.
Do we have the technology or the science to do the tracking of this? Is that without it being overly expensive?
Yep. And Senator Stoltz, we do have what they set up in Colorado is radio frequency ID tags, and they do have a registration computer verification system. So I think that we certainly could get it.
We can do a scientific, not like a coffee grower can take the sample and tell where it came from. I don't think that's a role for government.
Right. It would just monitor it, is my understanding of it. And as I'm sure
that's the tasting part.
Sure, yeah. And Cynthia Frank would probably say more in depth than I. But that's what I understand is going on in Colorado right now. And again, the tax burden is absorbed by the broker. The broker is the one that's is the money entity. That's what they handle, and they have the capability and the sophistication to handle the paying of taxes, which the home grower may not necessarily have. They may not be good at paperwork necessarily. They may not have the monetary capacity to pay the taxes. So it's just something to consider if you're trying to get these.
Can I ask a philosophical question? As we're dealing with other industries with brokers, is this process, do you envision this as a public process with all the data and information and sales available to the public, or is it the sponsor and the staff working on it? Does this become confidential information within Department of Revenue by your vision?
Senator Stoltz,
that would be a better question for others, but I'm asking you as a sponsor the intent.
Senator Stoltz, what I've come to, I suppose I can.
We come back to that one, but throw that one out as something we want to ponder as well.
I can tell you that the discussions have been that the presumption is that it is confidential for the department. It is related to tax information. I think you can make a compelling argument for that. And then, unless there's a compelling reason why not to, I think that would probably be your starting point.
Let's make that, as we proceed, let's make sure that discussion is very open on the record so it doesn't become a point of contention or controversy later, whatever that's fully vetted.
And Senator Stoltz, continuing on, this is the broker license. This is the person that's the middleman. It's the person that does the buying and the selling, and it buys from The processors, it buys from the boutique producers, it buys from the home growers, so the smaller entities, it buys from those folks and is responsible for the same tax as the big marijuana producer, and that's how you collect the tax from that segment of the market. Okay, so here's the vertical integration license. We'll just go through this quickly.
Mr. Chairman, if I could. This is also where testing becomes a significant issue, just to let you know that passing on to retailers, then I think one of the questions we're continually asking, whether it's for enforcement or for sale, what's the content here? And so this is probably one of the places where you're going to see that significantly.
Senator Carlo, that's correct. This is an important part of the broker and the producer's license. Before it goes to sale, there's going to be an element of testing to make sure that they have the sample size to figure out how much THC is in the product and then put it into the edible or the marijuana for retail. So here is the producer, processor, retail license. This is the true vertical integration. This is for the larger entities that want to be the producer, the processor, and the retailer. And this is a recommendation that came out of Colorado and Washington. There was an interest in this particular license, and so that's what you see there. They pay the $50 per ounce state tax, and they also may be subject to any municipal tax burdens.
This would be a case where we're not regulating it like alcohol, because alcohol has a pretty complex issue of even prohibiting this type of integration. Is that correct?
Senator Stoltz, that's my belief, and that's. But I'll defer to somebody that's got.
I just wouldn't want to go against the will of the initiative sponsors and the people, because they said regulate it like alcohol, as goofy as it might be. Got a smile from Bruce there.
And okay, so moving forward, the producer and processor, again, vertical integration, vertical partial integration, all you're eliminating there is the retailer component. It's just the producer and the processor. So here's a few, this is to wrap up. There's a few definitions that we have. We define marijuana, as you can read up there. There's a marijuana establishment. As we say before, it's the producer, it's the retailer, it's the boutique dealer. Marijuana products includes concentrated marijuana products, edible products, tinctures, ointments, and then a marijuana testing facility means a certified entity through DEC that analyzes the safety and potency of the marijuana. That's the safety provisions for the customers. And then a few other definitions. Some of this is a retread in some capacity, so if anyone has any questions about that, I'd be happy to answer them. Maybe off the record. So Section 28 can be regulated by home rule municipalities. This, again, this is some cleanup provisions. This relates to the home rule assessments. Section 29 reiterates what we've been discussing before about the payment of $50 per ounce for the broker and the producer. Section 30 talks about the statements that have to be done as it relates to the amount of marijuana sold and the taxes being assessed to the department. So monthly statements have to go from the producer and the broker to the department to get an assessment of how much tax is being collected by the state.
I have a question. It's usually most of my constituents don't like the metric system just philosophically, but it has easier divisions. What is an ounce is what, 28.3 or 4 grams, and it's easier to break down the units for partials as opposed to a tenth of an ounce. Has there been any thought about doing this by metric?
Senator Stoltz, not a lot of thought, but we're open to recommendations.
Well, I'm just thinking that's how they, we don't see quarts of distilled alcohol. We see liters and half liters.
Senator Stoltz, I think we're open to that conversation.
I don't, it's just a question, and Mr. Schulte can comment on that too.
Section 28, Section 31, penalties, civil penalties for tax deficiencies, the fairly standard operating procedure with there is tax deficiencies out in the commercial regulated world. Section 31, again, kind of a definition section that recaps what we've previously discussed. Section 31 is a cleanup provision. It deletes some of the provisions that may be that differ from the ballot to what SB 62 is trying to implement as it relates to regulation and license. And Section 34 states the moment that the bill legislation takes effect. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I can defer to...
And we did our best. I think all of our questions were pretty short, so that was the goal. Open forum here for any questions from members. Willikowski, Senator Willikowski, you've been... We'll look forward to it. I'm sure you'll have some suggestions as we get to the later process.
Lots to digest, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. This is a very crisp presentation. I appreciate it. And even with the interruptions, we kept on a pretty good schedule and tried to keep those limited to short questions. So I think we put a lot on the table for to come back to. So, Senator Huggins, did you have anything else? Thank you, Mr. Hutchins. I look forward to working with you and some more on this bill. Dr. Hinterberger, are you online?
Yes, I am. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. You're becoming a regular here, so you know the procedure. Look forward to your comments.
Very good. Chairman Stoltz and committee members, we appreciate legislators and staff's diligent work to craft a regulatory bill to supplement ballot measure 2, and we are pleased to see that SB 62 has already incorporated some of our previous input. We also support the new inclusion of registration for home growers, boutique producers, and marijuana brokers. So SB 62, as currently drafted, represents a substantial improvement upon the previous draft. However, we continue to have several concerns, which are detailed in a letter that I only just this morning sent to Mr. George in your office. So I apologize if that's not in your hands yet. It should soon be. And I'm prepared to go through...
Is that posted on basis?
I know that Mr. Schulte's testimony that he submitted yesterday overlaps considerably with our concerns, so I'll try to be brief to give him time to comment on them as well. The most serious concerns we have are the deletion of section of 1738070 in the initiative, which contained comprehensive legal protections for businesses and their employees. We also have serious concerns with the provision in SB 62 limiting the amount that can be sold per day per person. This would require extensive, intrusive record keeping on an individual basis, and hence would be illegal under the initiative, because under the initiative, individual purchase records for citizens cannot be maintained by businesses. We're also concerned that the licensing fees, as described in SB 62, would increase the total amount of the maximum application fee to beyond $5,000, again, in conflict with the initiative. And in general, we're concerned that the breadth of the circumstances when the Marijuana Control Board would be required to revoke or suspend a registration is excessively burdensome on businesses. Listening to Mr. Hutchins' description, it's clear that the committee and staff are aware of the need of the intent, really the goal of this whole thing is to eliminate the black market, reduce as much as possible, and eventually eliminate the black market, just as the black market for alcohol has been eliminated over several decades following the elimination of alcohol prohibition. But to have more and more burdensome regulations and measures placed upon legitimate licensed or registered marijuana growers is simply going to make it more difficult for a regulated industry to thrive successfully in Alaska, and to the extent that happens, it's going to encourage the black market. So if, with your permission, I'd like to take a little bit more time and go through some of these concerns.
Take the time you need, Doctor.
Well, let's just see. Let me take 5 minutes.
Yeah, take the time you need, you think, to adequately put this on the record.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay, so the current version of SB 62 deletes the, quote, notwithstanding phrase in the paraphernalia protections provision. And as we've stated in other testimony, we think that this is important protection for users. the current version of SB 62 uses broad language in banning advertising and packaging that may be enticing to minors. That was in Section 3. We enthusiastically support reasonable restrictions on advertising and efforts to prevent advertising from targeting minors, but we are concerned that, as stated, this may be vague and overbroad. Any advertising, even, you know, a listing in the Yellow Pages or online, could arguably be considered enticing a minor. So more precise guidance and prohibitions would be more appropriate. The current version changes registration to license throughout. And again, as we have stated in testimony on this, on other bills under consideration, the word registration was carefully chosen in light of court decisions on federal preemption. So even though it's true that, well, alcohol is a licensed activity in Alaska, under the current state of affairs, we believe registration would be more appropriate. The current version of SB 62, as I said, increases the total application fees beyond the $5,000 cap stated in the initiative. And it requires, rather than allows, a municipality to establish local licensing fees. Establishing licensing fees should be optional for municipalities. Some localities may prefer all licensing to be handled at the state level. SB 62 is currently drafted limits the amount that retailers can sell per day to adults, thus illegally requiring intrusive record keeping. To protect personal privacy, a right enshrined in the Alaska Constitution, Measure 2 prohibits regulations from requiring retailers to collect and record personal information about their consumers. The provision in SB 62 is illegal and especially worrisome in a day and age when so many records have been hacked. It's also unnecessary. It would be a crime for the person to possess more than an ounce of marijuana. The individual did not produce himself. Regarding other restrictions on legitimate businesses, SB 62 requires retailers to be closed from midnight to 8 a.m. And this really seems strange in a state where bars don't have to close until 5 a.m. under state law. It's puzzling why adults would have a midnight curfew on buying marijuana from a regulated business. We think that hours of operation are best left to the regulatory board or localities. SB 62 forbids retailers from selling to other licensees. Now, retailers may go out of business or find that a certain product doesn't sell in their market. They shouldn't be prohibited from selling their excess inventory to other retailers. It says that a marijuana producer cannot sell to a marijuana broker, but a broker may buy marijuana from a processor. I'm sorry, a marijuana processor cannot sell to a marijuana broker. This seems like a contradiction, unless we're misreading it. Now, there's a provision about community notice requirements. We think these are excessive for growers, particularly home growers. It says that each application and transfer would have to be posted at the proposed location. This would be unnecessary and would put small-scale growers at risk for theft, for instance. And also, regarding the desire to eliminate the black market, you know, somebody who's a black market grower could cynically protest or be opposed to the establishment of a regulated business that potentially would be legitimate competition for them. So this seems excessive, especially for home growers and boutique growers, along the same lines where SB 62 says that the board may require 3 weeks of paid notices in newspapers for anyone who applies for a license. This would be extremely costly and could make it impossible for small growers to participate. The board, according to SB 62, says the board, quote, shall suspend or revoke, unquote, a license if it finds the continued sale or manufacture of marijuana by the licensee would be contrary to, quote, the best interests of the public. This is vague and overly broad language. And it could allow a board that simply disagrees with voters' decision to make marijuana cultivation legal to revoke licenses. Licensees need notice of the rules and what is not permitted and should not be subject to personal judgment of the board. This sentence should be stricken. SB 62 says the board, quote, shall suspend or revoke a licensee if it finds that the licensee has failed to correct a defect that is in violation of, quote, other applicable law. Given that marijuana cultivation and sales still violate federal law, this should be revised to clearly only apply to state law. In several cases, SB 62 says a suspension or revocation of a regulation is required by the board. It should say that revocation should be allowed. The bill provides that the board must suspend or revoke a license for a number of reasons, like if the licensee fails to abide by public health, fire, safety regulations, or if anyone illegally gambles on the site. In some cases, such as for minor or inadvertent violations by a single employee, a civil fine may be more appropriate. The board should have discretion to impose a reasonable penalty rather than be forced to suspend or revoke a license. SB 62 grants the board overly broad authority to, quote, impose conditions or restrictions on a license. SB 62 says that only a licensee may have a direct or indirect financial interest in a license. As I'm sure Mr. Schulte is going to go into, this would create unnecessary obstacles to raising capital. SB 62 repeals comprehensive legal protections for marijuana establishments and their staff and replaces them with language that we feel is problematic. Ballot Measure 62 was carefully crafted to make marijuana establishments and their staff's conduct lawful and exempt from criminal penalties under state law. This proposal would delete such comprehensive legal protections and replace them with sections, quote, authorizing conduct. This would make the law more susceptible to a preemption challenge. I'm going to finish my testimony there and welcome any questions from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hinterberger. And while you were talking, your testimony has been, all the individual members here have it, and it's available outside, but it's now posted on bases as well, so the public can see it as well for their analysis. Any questions for the initiative sponsors? I want to first, before we go to Bruce Schulte, we are not going to get to the two Senate bills. I want to apologize to both Senator Giesel and Senator Gardner, and I want to ask members if any objection when I'd like to, those bills have now been noticed. I'd like to have one or more over the next 2 weeks, have a couple of 8 a.m. meetings. We have so much. We have a total of 180 minutes a week to try to deal with some pretty complex issues, as well as we have more bills in this committee than usually two or three other committees combined. So we're going to, with the members' support, and I know there's other subcommittee issues and stuff, I want to have some 8 a.m. meetings just so we can get to legislation that's piling up in committee, as well as dealing with this fairly time-consumptive issue of marijuana regulation. So my apologies to the two senators that were here. I would have felt we would have short-shrifted the conversation had we rushed that too much. So we have the ethics and the APOC bills. We'll get those up sometime next week, and we'll figure out talking to members and see if we can do it one or more 8 o'clock meetings if it jives with our Senate subcommittees. We'll do our best to work with everybody. We want to respect. I hate to have people sitting and waiting for meetings, but it's, we're doing our best here, senators. With that, and the public know, we won't be dealing with those two bills today. Mr. Schulte.
Good morning. My name is
Bruce Schulte. We're going to go a little past 10:30, so you'll need about 10 minutes, you said.
And yeah.
So we'll just the members know, we'll just a couple minutes past.
There's Kathy.
I don't know if she or staff are here, but... Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Bruce Schulte.
Asking here.
Sure. My name is Bruce Schulte. I'm a board member and spokesman for the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation, and I'm Thank you for having me here today and giving me the time to speak to the committee. As always, I greatly appreciate all the efforts of the committee members and staffers on this bill and others. I've been watching closely, and it's gratifying to see the amount of energy and thought that's been put into all of these, so thank you for that. I did submit some written comments. They're 9 pages long. I won't drag you through every point. I would like to just briefly hit on some of the key points that we think are particularly relevant. And if I may, I'd like to take two passes through these, and I'm going to do them in the order in which they were noted in my comments. Starting with the things that we're very enthusiastic about, on page 4 of my comments, we note the addition of additional licenses, the boutique license, the broker licenses. That's fantastic. We support that. We're gratified to see that in there. We think that reflects a very thoughtful approach to this industry, and we're very happy to see those articulated in this bill. In particular, the integrated licenses, I think, show a good understanding of the nature of this industry and where it could go. And we think that is also very important, as Mr. Hutchinson said, in encouraging and allowing the black market to move to a legitimate business model. We think that these expanded licenses and the integrated licenses will be one of many key components to make that happen. That said, I noticed that in the alcohol regulations, there's roughly 22 licenses of different types that are articulated. And so we would envision a scenario where as the industry gets established and things progress, as a regulatory board begins its work, we may see more licenses developed to address specific situations. And so for that reason, we would like to respectfully suggest that perhaps a better approach would be to define a broader framework for these licenses in statute and then allow the regulatory board to define the particulars of what each category of license can and cannot do and what their associated parameters are. That's just a suggestion, but again, we very much support the direction that this bill is taking us in. One note I would just touch on, sort of echoing Dr. Hinterberger's comments, we do think that confidentiality is an important consideration. As in many industries, there's business concerns that might come into play, and so we think that keeping confidentiality in mind and, when it comes to records and reporting and so forth is appropriate. So now moving on to
just on records or total confidentiality. I know in alcohol sales, police departments and local, they require camera monitors in there that the police can go. I mean that's a
Oh, sure. No, well, we're
I'm not suggesting that's a necessity, but we say we want to regulate this like alcohol. So I go to those default questions.
Absolutely. I think, well, specifically, some requirements for reporting and notice and record keeping, certainly the public has as a right and a need to understand and have input on licensing. That's agreed. Certain types of information may best be kept confidential for the board's review. For example, I think Dr. Hinterberger pointed out that a black market operator could actually object to a legitimate grower in their neighborhood just because they're conflicting. I'm not sure how to avoid that particular scenario, but I could see how that not every business would want every member of the public to know exactly what they're doing on site, just a, you know, a bank.
Community can, we've said, and we have activist citizens. They get upset when somebody drives their work pickup truck home that has their business license on there.
Right.
We do have. It's not. We're not inventing those scenarios. Those exist
sure.
with commerce activities within neighborhoods.
Sure. I understand, Senator. I'm just suggesting that there might be a balance there between the legitimate need of
Would that be a deference? Would you prefer a deference to localities, or would you like the state to regulate?
I would prefer deference to the localities, because I think they have a better handle on the dynamics in their communities.
Okay. That'll be a discussion point.
Okay. Okay, now moving back to page 3 of my comments, I want to talk a little bit about the revenue sharing. Ballot Measure 2 did articulate a mechanism whereby an application and a fee would be given to the state, and then 50% of the fee would accompany the application to the municipalities. That component is modified in this bill. We think that that's important because that revenue sharing, that term is not used, but I'm just going to use it for discussion purposes, that revenue sharing will help the local governments administer, offset the cost of administering their programs on a local level. We think that removing that sharing component would, in fact, potentially increase the total licensing application fees above $5,000 and make it difficult for the legitimate industry to compete with the black market. Just one of many components that could have that effect. So I just wanted to point that out, and we would prefer to see that revenue sharing back in where a local municipality like Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau would participate in that fee, that application fee, when it's first submitted. There's a provision here on page 4 of my notes. Let me see. There's a stipulation that a municipality shall establish both a regulatory board and regulations. Certainly some communities will do that. We support that, and we would hope to work with those communities in that regard. But some of the smaller communities may not have the resources to do that. And so it would be our hope that at the state level, the statutes and rules are sufficient that some of the smaller communities could simply look at those and say, okay, that works for us. Give us our 50% of the application fee, and we will allow these businesses. You know, they may have some additional zoning considerations, for example, but to require them to have a regulatory board or entity and to establish rules might be more of a burden on the individual communities than they're prepared to take on, and they may just ban everything just as a default because they can't meet that requirement. And here on this next item, page 5 of my comments, I'm just going to echo what Dr. Hitterberg said about the 1 ounce limit. Certainly, we agree that your 1 ounce in possession is in fact lawful. Beyond that is not. Limiting that at the retail level is problematic the way it's phrased here because, as Dr. Hinterberger pointed out, to limit sales of 1 ounce per day does require a fair degree of record keeping that would be very difficult to achieve and, in fact, is specifically disallowed under the text of the initiative. I'm trying to think of a better term for that because it sounds...
Speaking of the ounces, are any... Yes, you're representing the interests of the commercialization effort, and whether we use the more dividable metric system or the...
You know,
and I hear in drug sales, it's usually on milligrams. That's how...
Thank you, Senator. That is a really good question, and I was curious at that. Historically, marijuana has typically been sold in ounces and grams. The subdivisions are often, you know, a half ounce, quarter ounce, eighth ounce. Lower than that, it's typically grams. I think in terms of when you're talking about hash.
And doses of THC are measured in milligrams, generally, right? That's how Colorado does it.
In practice, I'm trying to make the distinction here. For purposes of measuring potency and labeling, yes, milligrams of THC does come into play. For marketing purposes, for purposes of commerce, it's typically ounces and grams. I'm not sure if I'm making that clear, but
it really doesn't matter a lot to me. I'm not going to be buying it, but we're trying to regulate it, tax it, scale it, and so forth. It's sure. just again, it's not the biggest issue we're dealing with here. Colorado on that limit, Colorado has made the ounce per day limit, and we're looking at Colorado as a model on a lot of this stuff.
Sure.
You have a disparate view from the way they do it in Colorado then?
Well, Senator, thank you. I don't disagree with it in principle.
I'm not advocating. I'm only expressing what one state is saying.
Sure.
We appear to be using Colorado as the model as it was presented.
Sure. And it is a good model, and certainly we would look to them also for some guidance. I don't disagree with it in principle. I think that it is problematic to actually put into place simply because in order to absolutely guarantee that one individual is not buying more than 1 ounce per day, one really has to take copious records, you know, personal identification, not just for verification of age, but actually, you know, record that individual's presence in a store that day, and if they come back that night to buy another ounce, that gets to the whole level of record keeping. That it's not just onerous. I think it's overly intrusive. I think a lot of people would avoid going into such a store precisely because they know that sort of record keeping is taking place.
The alcohol industry, the retail, not only do they have discretion, they also have state mandates about not serving or selling to certain people. And how does that integrate into, does marijuana have any parallels to that?
Senator, not that I'm aware of.
I default to regulate it like alcohol.
Sure,
and that's
sure.
Your slogan, not mine.
Sure, no, I don't dispute that. I think this kind of gets a little off topic, but in the case of alcohol, many of us could recognize somebody who is inebriated, and certainly a bartender or a store owner would have the authority and the perhaps the responsibility to not serve that person further. I'm not sure that we would see the same dynamic in a marijuana retail store, unless I suppose if somebody comes into a marijuana store and they're drunk, I could see some provision coming into play such as you described, but I'm not sure how you would achieve that, because then you would require retail store employees to perform some of the evaluation that bartenders and waiters and waitresses are required to do. I'm not sure if that's practical.
Well, certainly give that some more thought. I guess I don't know scenarios, but again, I'm just going to the default position. I'm trying to honor the that was the theme, regulated like alcohol. And is it regulated like alcohol sometimes or not? Maybe we should change it.
Senator, I that's why I was chuckling in the back earlier, because I get that. Whenever I'm looking at one of these portions of statute, that's always in the back of my mind. What did they do with alcohol? It is a valid point. As you point out, that was, in fact, the catchphrase for the campaign, so I respect that. I've just got a couple more points here. I won't belabor the 1 ounce per day limit. I agree that in principle, I just think that the way it's phrased here would be very difficult to implement. Going back to page 7 of my notes, there is a section here that Dr. Hinterberger referenced that I'd like to just reiterate. There are several sections here that say that the board shall deny a license under one of many circumstances. And I don't deny that some of those circumstances should perhaps entail denial of a license or some sort of sanction. My concern is that by putting this level of language into statute, it doesn't give the board any discretion to apply other sanctions. For example, I can't give you a specific example, but there might be a case where a license holder has committed some infraction that warrants a sanction, but not necessarily a revocation of their license or a denial of a license. Perhaps a fine or a suspension would be more appropriate. And our concern is that with this particular language, it doesn't give the board the latitude to make that determination. And in addition, now I'm a sort of contradict myself a little bit here, and I recognize that going in. It further stipulates that the board shall deny a license when it's not in the best interests of the public, which is a vague term.
Which is subjective.
It is very subjective. So I will acknowledge, on the one hand, I'm saying the board should have the ability to make subjective determinations, and on the other hand, I'm saying the board shouldn't be making subjective determinations. I understand the contradiction there, but I guess we would just hope that the statutes would define an overall regulatory environment and leave some of the detail to a regulatory board who might be better positioned to consider the specifics of a particular case and to apply an appropriate sanction rather than denial or revocation of a license. Two last items here. Page 8 of my notes, and this is sort of a big one. Let me just say right off, I just want to reiterate, we really appreciate all the effort and thought that has gone into this bill and others. You guys, staffers and elected officials alike, are doing an awesome job. So please don't take anything I say here as being intentionally critical. That said, on page 8, the item, the section entitled Prohibited Financial Interest, as an Alaska-based businessman, and indeed our entire group is Alaska-based, we support the intent of keeping this business in Alaska. That said, there are situations where we may need to reach out to investors, individuals or groups outside of the state. for funding to grow a business, to establish a business. One example would be a testing lab. You know, done right, that could be a very, very expensive proposition. Could be very profitable, certainly going to be necessary, but somebody here who has the expertise may not have the many hundreds of thousands of dollars necessary. So we would like them to have the ability to reach out to outside investors for, you know, to gain the resources to develop their business. I don't have a specific recommendation on how to rephrase the section. As I said, I agree with the intent, but I think the way it's phrased is problematic. It almost demands that one either be a very, very wealthy individual and ability to self-fund their business entirely, or they be a corporation that has you know multiple financial interests involved. It's sort of,
maybe that's the next initiative: get big money out of marijuana.
Right. Well, Senator, one of the concerns during the campaign was, you know, to keep big marijuana out of the Alaska industry. And I'll be honest with you, as a small business owner, I sort of support that. But I also recognize that, you know, some of us are going to have to reach out for financing, and we would hope that this would be crafted in a way that it would allow for that while keeping the focus on Alaska-based businesses. And to be fair, now I'm not a lawyer, but other lawyers have told me that legal precedent around the country with regard to interstate commerce may actually impact this section. Like we may not be able to limit it as much as I might even want to, just because of legal precedent elsewhere in the country.
Interstate commerce with a federally illegal substance, do you think that's really a pressing issue?
That is a fair point, Senator. I don't know how that would play out in our
Senator
court.
Coghill?
Actually, you brought up the point I was taking. I think that as we go through this regulatory scheme, we always are trying to keep an eye on who will help you finance that. And so looking to Alaska institutions and how they might stand up is going to be a big part of this question. So, but we are still going to have to deal with the interstate commerce question, including transportation issues. So that's going to be wrapped up into this question, just for what it's worth.
Understood.
I just have one question. It's the last one I'll ask today, and that's on the licenses. I just want to reemphasize or amplify whatever your position is. Do you believe that there should be a economic value attached to this, to a license? Should it be transferable? Should it be akin to a liquor license or a limited entry permit or a taxi cab medallion? Or should it be available on some type of other dispersal?
Thank you, Senator. I would hope that the licenses would not go the way of alcohol licenses. I think we've seen cases where, you know, alcohol licenses become a very expensive commodity in and of themselves. And we believe that would actually be an impediment to businesses that want to go legitimate and could actually skew the industry in an undesirable direction. So, yeah, we would hope that the licenses would all refer back to the regulatory board and have an equal footing, whether it's a new license or a renewal or a transfer.
And on that issue, do you believe it is the either specific or implied intent of the initiative to have this to limit or prohibit licenses from being owned outside the way it's written?
Being limited from outside, you mean outside of the state?
It's very common to have a liquor license holder from outside of Alaska or a medallion, taxi cab medallion permit holder from outside. That's actually probably more common than not.
Right. Senator, thank you. Honestly, from the text of the initiative, I don't recall seeing that specific notion articulated. I'm speaking more as from an industry perspective of folks that would like to set up a legitimate industry business in the state. That's what we would like to see.
If you think about this, provides more. And I think the intent appeared to be to have Alaskan-based businesses and the things we can avoid doing intentionally or unintentionally. Any other questions for Mr. Schulte? We haven't had anything from Senator Wilkowski.
Comment, but I think it should be Alaska businesses. I think we should put a strong provision in there. It's got to be Alaska residents, Alaska businesses, Alaska residents. And if outsiders want to come in, let them sue us in federal district court and see what the courts say there.
Senator Rick Huggins.
Yeah, you don't have to answer this unless you have it right at the tip of your tongue, but there are certain people that are licensed. I don't know if you're an airplane pilot, you've got to have an FAA license. If you fly Alaska Airlines, should there be a prohibited sale to those kinds of people because they're licensed at a level that violates their licensure?
Thank you, Senator. Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I think I can speak to this from personal experience because I am a commercial pilot. And as such, I recognize that in my employment, I am limited in what I can do with regard to alcohol and marijuana, and I respect that. So to answer your question, I think, no, that should not be on the retailer to determine. I think it's up to the individual to respect the terms of their employment and the environment that they're working in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I just wanted, just because you're advocating the sale, I think there was the successful bar owners, they had an adage, whiskey's for selling, not for drinking.
Oh, okay. I like that.
Not to provide any stereotypes.
I don't think this was your question, but it does make me a rather unlikely advocate for this whole effort since, as I just pointed out, I don't really get to participate most of the year, and I'm fine with that.
I was sort of giving you a gentle way to
yeah. That's a personal choice that I make, and I would contend that many folks make similar responsible choices in their careers and in their lives, and I would encourage them to do so, just as I've done. If I may, Senator, earlier the question came up about tinctures, and if I could just address that very briefly. A tincture is, you could think of it as a diluted form of hash oil, and it's often found in medical applications. In fact, CNN did a piece last summer in which they spoke. They looked at the use of medical marijuana in Colorado. A notable case was a young girl named Charlotte, for whom a strain, Charlotte's Web, was developed. And in those applications, particularly for medical patients, a tincture is used where it's a hash oil that's diluted with some alcohols of some sort to just make it a little bit more viscous, and it's just administered orally through a dropper or something. That's the most common application I'm aware of.
Thank you, Mr. Shelby. We're going to have to stop here today. I'm going to give you one more homework assignment, and that's as a representative of the commercialization is, can you give us provide us some commentary, and we'll bring you back again on how do we protect? You know, we talked about Dr. Hinderberg protecting and indemnifying businesses and employees. Mm-hmm. What about the potential victims of as we have our society is built on a fabric of the social compact involving insurance coverage and how. I think that's an item that hasn't been mentioned in this legislation, but we did have a division of insurance, and we don't have time to delve into that, but give us some of your thoughts on how Alaskans can be protected by having that umbrella of coverage for misuse and, their alcohol certainly has insurance requirements, and that's a big assignment, and every insurance agent I've talked to has said they have no idea how they'd even write the risk portfolio on this new thing. And we'd like to come back to that. We don't have time, but leave that one hanging. That's a very serious element to this whole discussion.
Sure.
And okay. So with that, we will stand in adjournment with our thanks to our testifiers.